Hello, everyone. Welcome to Energy Security Cubed, where we explore the pillars that form the nexus of energy security in Canada and the world: energy, economics, and the environment. I'm your host, CEO of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle. On today's episode, recorded March 17, 2022, we consider the challenges of establishing the intermediary steps in the supply chain for batteries, meaning the products and processes that stand between battery metals mining and final battery cell manufacturing, and the potential benefits of next-generation batteries for the future energy systems. Really pleased to have joined me from Denver, Colorado, Dean Frankel. Dean is the Chief Commercial Officer for Li-Metal. Prior to joining Li-Metal, Dean held various roles in the battery sector, including business development at Solid Power and lead analyst for energy storage research at Lux Research. Welcome to Energy Security Cube, Dean.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't we start with you telling us a bit about Li-Metal, how it started and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Li-Metal was started, I think, 4 years ago on paper. Operations began just about 3.5 years ago. By Maciej Jastrzebski and Tim Johnston. Tim is the current is also the co-founder of Li-Cycle, which is a Canadian or North American.
Yeah, we've had Li-Cycle on the podcast a couple of times.
There we go. I should have known that. And so with Maciej and Tim were really focused on the next generation battery value chain, and specifically bringing lithium metal to market in a more cost-effective way. My story intersects there is about a year later or so, when they approached me saying that they could reduce the cost of lithium metal, which is the primary metal input that would go into next generation batteries, but it also has some industrial uses today. And I told them, cutting the cost of lithium metal, and at that point, their projections were about 20 or 30%, is really helpful. But the issue that I was facing at Solid Power procuring lithium metal anodes was that the cost was really an order of magnitude too high, literally a factor of 10. And so very quickly, the company developed an anode strategy, and our discussions continued on the purchasing side of things. And eventually I got really excited and decided to join the company full time almost exactly a year ago.
Outstanding. So go a little deeper into the discussion of anode versus the anode part of the battery, and the benefits thereof of a lithium metal anode over a battery with a battery would have a graphite anode. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So your standard lithium ion battery today is a sandwich. The two bread layers, so to speak, the active materials are going to be your cathode and your anode. Your anode today is graphite. It does not participate in the movement of lithium. It's really just a host structure. So lithium goes from, a discharge state where it's in the cathode, and then lithium ions move across a separator membrane and into the anode today, which is a graphite matrix. When you go to discharge the battery, the opposite happens. So you have lithium moves from carbon intermediary across the separator through a liquid electrolyte material and into the cathode. So we don't really touch the cathode in our business. We are really focused, when I say our business, I mean Li-Metal. We are really focused on the anode, and in particular, displacing graphite anodes with a lithium metal anode. But we also think there's a real key role to play for silicon anodes. And so when we look at the periodic table today, pretty much nothing is better than lithium metal itself as storing energy. It is widely considered to be the holy grail of battery materials. And, if you go to the drugstore today and get those small coin cell batteries, which are often CR2032 would be the right format, that's actually a lithium metal battery. It just doesn't recharge. And so what we've been able to do over the past 40 or 50 years of battery science and engineering is get lithium metal to reliably recharge. And when I say we, that would be an example of a customer of Li-Metal, someone who's done a lot of research on allowing lithium metal to displace graphite as the anode, and in so doing, increase the energy density by 50 or 100%. So why would we even want to bring lithium metal into the battery? It's really about lightening the battery up, about increasing range, and ultimately improving performance, particularly from an energy density standpoint.
A few weeks ago, you announced that you'd be partnering with Blue Solutions on the use of Li metal products in solid-state batteries. Can you give an overview of a solid-state battery and the difference in supply chains for those batteries compared to, I think you've started to do that with what you just told us, for those batteries compared to a current lithium-ion battery. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I...
Trying not to be too technical, Dean, here. Try to dumb, always, bring this down to us.
Even the definition of a solid-state battery is a solid-state battery should mean that there's no liquid in it. I think some people are unfortunately bastardizing the terms because they're replacing one material but not the other, but we don't need to go into the weeds from the start. So let's start high level. Batteries are a sandwich, right? The ends of those sandwiches are the active materials, the cathode and the anode. In between that sandwich, the active materials layer, is a separator. The goal of the separator is to allow lithium ions to pass, but not electrons. And that allows you to get electricity out of the cell instead of having it pass through it, which would mean that you have a short. Not really good. So one material is a separator. The separator does not conduct lithium ions, but it allows it to pass through. You need a conductor of lithium ions that has ionic conductivity. So it allows lithium to move freely between cathode and anode. And the best materials that we have today that are commercial, I should say, are liquid electrolytes. They are organic-based materials. They have a relatively low flash point, which is really important from a safety standpoint. So they are typically the lowest common denominator in all battery thermal runaway events, which are often called battery fires.
Right.
So there's some major reasons why we might want to replace the liquid electrolyte. Additionally, a lot of the reasons why we want to get to higher energy density batteries, like as you get higher and higher, it becomes harder and harder to have a safer package. Because you're literally just packing more energy density in a box. And then there's probably one more compounding factor without going too technical, which is that the electrolyte that I spoke about, this medium, the electrolyte is like the highway. Like you need a road to move, like you could, you need a road to move your car, you need an electrolyte to move lithium. It's as simple as that. But the electrolyte can also impact the lithium, impact the battery performance, and particularly react with the anode. And so if we want to go to these next generation anode materials, so moving from graphite to silicon or from graphite to lithium, we need new electrolytes. And that's where solid state comes in. So solid state is really about removing that liquid electrolyte. You remove the liquid medium for the highway. You replace it with a solid material, and you also allow the use of ideally high energy anodes. So what does that promise? Like when you sum it all up, higher energy density and higher safety.
And lower weight.
Energy density is typically, to use the term twice, it's a bastardized term. It implies watt hours per liter, so energy per unit volume, but it is also interchangeably used with watt hours per kilogram, energy per unit weight. So if I were to increase the watt hours per kilogram by, let's say, 50 or 100%, that means that I'm effectively halving the weight per the same unit energy.
I think that's really important. I don't know enough about this, but I do know that energy density, mass, and volume are components of what you can generate or you do with the particular energy carrier. So that's interesting.
You know, as we get to bigger and bigger vehicles, it becomes increasingly more important to cut the mass and the volume.
Yeah, you can only make the vehicle so bit small, right? Especially if it's like when I'm thinking of transit, for instance. You know, the mm-hmm. things that in my mind are the low-hanging fruit of electrical transportation, you know, but everything has nothing happens for free. There's an equal and opposite reaction to weight, right? So I want to bring this into a bit of a global perspective, Dean. Mm-hmm. You know, like metal must face hefty competition from companies mostly in Asia, I'm going to guess, that produce the vast majority of the world's anode materials. What are your advantages to compete on a cost basis with these players? And how about product? What's your route to that?
Yeah, so the incumbent material is really graphite, and that is definitely an Asian dominated material. The processing and production of the anodes is currently done in-house at the battery cell manufacturer. So that is still in Asia, but I would say really distributed. It's increasingly going to happen in Europe, US, and even Canada, where you take this graphite, you put it in a slurry, like a soupy material, and then you ultimately coat and dry it into a layer. So it looks like a copper foil with a black mass in the middle. Everything in batteries is done roll to roll, so it looks like a paper towel roll with some black in the middle, and that's your anode. And the majority of the manufacturing of that outside of the raw material is done at the point of battery manufacturing. And so that step is happening more and more outside of Asia. I think regionalization of batteries is a real thing. So that's the incumbent. And I say it's really important to start at the incumbent because, lithium metal is really not widely commercialized today. You mentioned Blue Solutions, our partner earlier. They are the largest commercial player in lithium metal batteries. And they're currently supplying a bus for, a bus model for Daimler. So the market today for lithium metal is really a fraction of what graphite is. With that said, yes, most of the players are in Asia. And going even deeper, what differentiates us, it's really that we're built to be cost effective. The existing industry is really a top-down industry. You take something that's really big, you squeeze it, and you continue to squeeze it and roll it, similar to how you would make aluminum foil that you might find at your supermarket.
Right.
Lithium metal's really difficult to do that with. It's prone to tears. It has a tenth the mechanical strength of aluminum. It reacts with everything in air. It sticks to itself. It's just all these ridiculous constraints because it's so good at reacting with material,
right,
which is great when it's in a battery. It's not good when it's
you got to get it in there.
Manufacturing process. Yeah. So I know I'm probably going over here, but I'll just.
Absolutely, because I'm gonna open this up, this part of the conversation up a little bit, because I think that I don't think people quite understand they're starting to see it in the markets, like the cost of lithium, for instance, and it's always the better mousetrap, right? So carry on, Dean. Carry on. I've got a couple more questions along this line, but carry on.
Yeah. So I would say one thing that differentiates Li-Metal is that we are really built to be cost effective. So this whole industry is built on a top-down model where you start with something big, you squeeze it, compress it, mechanically roll it, similar to how you would make aluminum foil at a supermarket. We are basically a giant spray painting operation. So if you've ever had a potato chip, a bag of potato chips,
I've never tried them.
You may notice that the inside of the potato chip bag is a shiny foil. That is aluminum, actually. And how they produce it is they take a polymer layer in a roll-to-roll film, and they're depositing aluminum, basically spray painting aluminum under vacuum conditions to get that aluminum layer really cheaply onto a fast-moving polymer substrate. And that's really analogous to what we're trying to do. So we're a bottom-up manufacturing process. Instead of starting with something big and going to something thin, we start with zero and build up from there. So we can get really, really thin. We can go as wide as the battery materials need to be. And my shoulders aren't wide enough to show you, but I mean, today, industry standard widths are up to and over 1 meter. So we can actually meet that. Whereas lithium metal, it's so soft that doing the top-down method, you're never going to be able to get to 1 meter in width. So that's one of the key advantages of what we do. And ultimately that means that we can be more cost effective.
So I'm thinking, and I'm going off script here, Dean. So please, but I do that now and then. So graphite is a carbon material, right?
Correct.
And like, I've heard little rumblings here, and you know, as you know, I'm sitting in Calgary. I've been in the oil and gas industry for several decades. I'll just leave it at several decades. I've been around heavy oil and the oil sands for a long part of that. Is there not some discussion of one of the derivatives of the oil sands being carbon fiber? Like, there's a fairly large supply there. I'm not being facetious, yeah. Could that be part of the discussion?
So carbon fiber is infrequently used, and I would say practically never used in batteries today. But
how do you get the graphite? But we're trying to use graphite, right?
Correct. So we use graphite. It is like a flake graphite. There are two types of graphite by and large, and I'm sure if we wanted to get technical, we could probably even go deeper than that, based on like how the carbon is actually structured. But by and large, there's natural flake graphite. These are mined materials.
Okay,
Then secondly, there is what is called artificial graphite, and that is usually processed from petroleum coke. So again, it's not my favorite material in the world. It's not the cleanest material in the world, but also from a supply chain standpoint and from a North American standpoint, what is nice about artificial graphite is that there are existing petroleum coke operations. So for example, I know a little less about Canada, but in the US, I think Phillips 66 or ConocoPhillips, one of those two, has a significant operation. So that is definitely an area where we can kind of take like old coal industries or old petroleum processing industries and convert them into battery materials today. Our goal as a company is to get rid of graphite entirely. However, I think graphite has a long runway. Just, even if we smash it out of the ballpark, graphite's still going to be around in batteries for the next decade. It's at some level.
But your goal is to not have graphite either then?
Correct.
Okay.
I say our goal, it's our goal, but it's really, we are a component supplier into the people who ultimately make the batteries and who design the batteries. So yeah, at the end of the day, it's also it should be their goal, but it's really how well our customers can do their jobs and how well the OEMs, the automakers, can bring those products to market.
Yeah. And you're trying to facilitate opportunity with your customers. So that makes a lot of sense. In the last week or two, especially since the conflict and war that's going on in Ukraine, volatility in nickel prices caused by that invasion of the Ukraine, as you're fully aware, there was a short squeeze on the London Metals Exchange last week, and they had to shut the exchange down, or a bunch of trading companies would have gone broke. Could you give me your take on this, these events? Does this change any, where does nickel fit, or other materials besides lithium, fit into the, like, can this happen in other metals trade? Those are very troubling things geopolitically and existentially. Think about supply chains. Give us your view on that.
Yeah, there's some real pain happening. And it is not beneficial in the long run to have such high material prices. It's destructive to demand. It is just not ideal, not really good for anyone. Even if you're selling at $100 a kilogram, that's a short-term gain. My first comment is, I don't know why anyone would be short nickel, because batteries take up maybe 10% or so of nickel demand today, and that number is rapidly rising. We've searched a lot for nickel. We can bring more nickel assets online, but I am quite bullish in nickel for the foreseeable future. But there are absolutely substitutes. For example, our partner in Blue Solutions is an LFP based cathode.
Explain
that. Yeah, lithium iron phosphate. So iron is certainly a much more abundant primary transition metal than nickel, and so that would be that would be, and the costs reflect that. I mean,
is it as good a conductor though?
So so conductor is a hard term, but
I'm an old guy, Dean. You got to remember, I'm dealing with a 6-volt pour liquid acid in. Okay, so remember who I am.
Oh man, yeah, I've done that maybe once or twice in my life. So yeah, I hope that future generations won't know what it's like to manually flood a battery. Okay. So it's not as good. It's not the conductivity that matters. Typically what matters is basically the dollars per kilogram that you can buy the raw material and how much energy you get out with each unit kilogram. So what I would say the watt hours per kilogram, coming back to that gravimetric energy density metric before, energy by weight. And you're right. LFP is not as good, but it is much cheaper. And so we've seen a flip in the market where like the lower priced vehicles that where, you know, this gravimetric energy density, energy by weight isn't as important, are switching from NMC, which is the nickel, manganese and cobalt variant that's primarily nickel, to a LFP. Both of those materials contain lithium. It's not like you're getting lithium out, but the bulk of the weight comes from those other metals, the iron phosphate, and then also the nickel, manganese and cobalt. So there is some substitutes. I wouldn't have been the person shorting the market in nickel. And it is it's impossible to extract geopolitics from metals prices, and batteries are by and large made up of metals. And that's like 80% of the cost of the end unit battery. So we can do a really, really good job pushing the technology, increasing the energy density, but the best hedge against rising material prices is increased energy density. But to increase energy density by the amount in which nickel rose, you know, in 1 or 2 days,
right,
is not possible on that time scale. Like, it's possible on a multi-year time scale. And so what does that mean? It means ultimately if you were to purchase nickel at $100 a kilogram, that's going to be a big burden in terms of the increasing cost of your battery.
That sums it up. Let's zoom out for a minute here. Lithium ion batteries are currently the dominant technology for phones, storage, but as more technologies develop, we might see different technologies. Do you think that's true, or do you think there's a single other, or is this the clear technology emerging as the go-to for many different applications now and in the future? And Dean, to just take that a little bit further, what, you know, the geopolitically, we're going to get in a crunch here. Mm-hmm. I think that in my mind that this is preliminary to other things China may do, hopefully not kinetically, like this, what's going on in Ukraine. But where's North America? Are we on the right path? Are we a day late and a dollar short? Or let's sum up with what you're thinking about the future of battery technologies here.
I certainly hope we're not. I think that there's a real role to play in regionalization of battery supply chains. I'm going to answer your second question first.
Yeah, that it's the more important question, Dean. It is.
So the auto industry in particular is, if you look at the transition from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles, a lot of the know-how and IP of each unique automaker came in their powertrain. And then all of a sudden, they're basically completely removing the powertrain, removing all of these parts, like so many less moving parts, which is great because the vehicle is way more efficient. But from a business model standpoint, it means that like you need to figure out how to make your same profit margin per vehicle. And one way to do that is to bring battery manufacturing, battery pack integration closer to house. So literally making it so that you're not purchasing batteries from Asia, which, you know, just from an economics and shipping perspective has challenges, but you know, you may want to form a joint venture with your cell supplier. You may want to do cell supply and or cell production. When I say cell, I mean, you know, individual battery units, of which there are hundreds or thousands per electric vehicle. And also make sure that you're doing the assembly of those, you know, single units into a single battery pack, which is basically the architecture of the powertrain for electric vehicles. And so you're gaining more and more of that core competency. You're bringing that IP, that know-how, and that profit margin closer back to home in this transition from ICE to electric vehicles. And in turn, you're regionalizing battery manufacturing and hopefully regionalizing supply chain thereafter. So that those are trends that are in play today. So I certainly hope we're not a day late and a dollar short. We're not doing it at the same scale that, you know, let's say battery production exists today in Asia. And so there is some catching up to do. And, you know, it's an open question as to whether North America as a region is going to be, and I would say Europe as well, are going to be successful in doing that. But right now, it does appear that, that's in play and that they should be successful. There's not an inherent manufacturing advantage to going to Asia. You know, there is speed, there is slightly lower capex in bringing plants online. But if we can be fast, this is not a super labor intensive process. It really is a process that I think can be done outside of Asia successfully. I think I answered both your questions.
Yeah, right? You did. And I'm just going to take
lithium. No, you asked lithium. Why lithium? Or can you displace lithium? And that's a really important question. So I will, before you.
No, go ahead, Dean. This is about, listening. Go ahead.
Lithium is the lightest metal. It's element number 3. It's a really good charge carrier per weight. I do not see lithium being displaced in just about every application. There's probably some exceptions to that. So one is the grid. There are, let's say, if we wanted to have like 10 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 2 days or 3 days of battery storage, you get to a point where incrementally adding more and more lithium ion batteries to that application becomes uneconomic. And so I think for long duration energy storage on the grid, there are a plenty of alternative chemistries that can come into play. People have previously looked to flow batteries, which use like liquid as the storage medium. So it's a little bit different than lithium ion based batteries. And also even like iron air batteries are being tried out by a company like Form Energy. And it's basically effectively rusting the battery and using the oxidation of that to drive the electricity in and out of the battery. So that's kind of a unique one. Maybe just one more point, but for anything that's a high energy battery, lithium based batteries are not going away. The reason why I don't say lithium ion is because lithium metal actually works a little bit differently. So when you put lithium metal in the anode, it's no longer a lithium ion battery. It is now lithium metal. There's probably one maybe potential competitor for some of the lower value applications, and that's sodium ion based batteries. There's been some significant progress, and one of the largest battery manufacturers, CATL, out of China, did say that they are going to try and bring a sodium ion battery to market. Most likely that would be like a lower value competing with LFP, that lower energy cathode. So there is definitely an energy penalty, but lithium is king.
Yeah, so you just have to find the right applications, and I don't want to go down in the weeds there. I just want to end by, watching the news media today, Ford and General Motors are all in on this. Like, they're fully in. There's no backing out of their longer term strategy about vehicular transportation. It's everywhere. I see the Lyric ad or the new Chev truck or the Lightning, or this is everywhere. So, and the flippant comments by the CEO of General Motors, I'll be candid, about their supply chain, tells me that they've got a plan. And, the more that can be North American based, the better, in my opinion. So do you feel that, I get going back to my question about a dominant technology that might change, is there something that hasn't been done yet, do you think, in the ZEV technologies, other than like you talked a little bit about drivetrain and weight and the component number of component parts, but is there something else here? Like, is this, I guess my question, Dean, sorry, is this strategic move by the big auto makers, is there something that hasn't been done yet that they're counting on, kind of like the hydrogen model for energy? Like, it's all going to happen. We're going to be zero emissions because hydrogen is going to save the world. Well, sorry, there's a lot of things that have to happen before that happens. Is some of this still reaching for the holy grail? I really feel like that I'm worried that they're counting on something that isn't there yet. Is that, am I way off base here? Or,
I mean, what isn't there yet is that they haven't made, 80 million vehicles that the world, or 100 million vehicles that the world demands. And I think that has to be the goal. is to really displace everything. So we're starting maybe a little bit slower and rockier than we could have. We need the raw materials to fuel this. And then ultimately to get, you know, let's say probably the 80, if we take the 80-20 model, if it's going to be hard to electrify the last 20%, we need higher energy density materials like lithium metal to probably push us across the finish line. Like lithium ion batteries are great today, but we need to continue to push the innovation ball forward to get to that last 20% at a minimum.
Yeah.
And ultimately to do it faster. I mean, the faster we can have higher energy density batteries, the more successful we'll be in as an industry in commercializing.
Well, and I'll just give a full face on example. Personally, I have a farm 500 kilometers from here. I go out there in the wintertime when it's 30 below. I'm pretty concerned about driving I drive an F-150. Okay.
Yeah.
So driving a Lightning out there would be, I don't know that I would do that today. I wouldn't probably I would not take the risk. Like I drove
from Colorado to Bozeman, Montana, which was 10 and a half hours. And it was almost that cold. Okay. It wasn't that cold. It was -17°C or -16°C. It was one of the coldest days of the year.
Zero Fahrenheit.
I think isn't that colder? I don't know. I have to.
Minus 18 is zero.
Okay. It was probably -7°F. So whatever that is, good. I'm glad that your mental conversion is better than mine. So it's possible. Look, it's not that cold. I mean, there are a host of challenges. Cold temperatures are absolutely one. But infrastructure is getting better and better. At some point, 500 kilometers, you might be able to do in a shot without going to the bathroom or needing to eat. But at some point, probably around the 500 kilometer mark, you're going to want to do that. And that's where charging and convenience charging comes in and makes it really convenient to, 10, 15 minutes, stop, plug in, get enough to make it to your destination with at least some buffer zone and be fine. So it is a slight behavior change, but I think it's a pretty manageable one.
So yeah, it's not so much the question of that technology; it's the question of the infrastructure, and that's in parallel to building out the vehicular line is the challenge, right? So, especially in places like where from here to Saskatchewan is there's just. Anyways, I'm digressing. Dean, it's been great. I really enjoyed having you on. We just have one last question. I always ask our guests what they're reading these days, because you can't just stick with technical manuals, Dean. You got to, open your life, read widely. What are you reading?
Yeah. I was most recently reading Genius, which is a biography of Richard Feynman.
Cool. Thanks a lot, Dean.
Thank you for having me here today.
Thanks everyone for listening to this episode of Energy Security Cubed on the Canadian Global Affairs Podcast Network. You can find the CGAI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give it a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. If you like this episode and want to help us keep creating content, you can support us by donating at cgai.ca/support. Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Joe Kalnan, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.